Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. This is 2022-0047 in the matter of Jerry Ray versus Ice House Ventures for the appellant. Mr. Miller, good morning.
Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. Joe Miller and Danielle Rice on behalf of appellants, who I may collectively refer to as Ice House or Ice House Ventures, I would ask to please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. If left to stand, the 10th District decision creates new law and presents a real threat to contracting parties and litigants in courts across Ohio alike. Without any evidence and support, based solely upon the speculation of counsel for ODOT, the Court of Appeals created a new element and burden in Ohio for contracting parties who seek to establish the opposing party breached an agreement. To affirmatively prove a meeting of the minds, even when a contract has been fully and fairly negotiated and signed, and even when the contesting party has brought forth no evidence to undermine a presumption of the meeting of the minds. What is more, equally important, the lower court's decision completely undermines an Ohio trial court's authority to interpret and enforce its judgments, giving parties a new veto right over such enforcement, even when the party previously agreed and asked the court to enter the agreement as its own order, and even when it brings forth no evidence to support that it did not fully understand that to which it agreed and signed. This decision creates doubt where none should exist in the validity of contracts for businesses and persons across Ohio, and this decision creates doubt where none should exist as to whether an Ohio trial court has the power and ability to interpret and enforce its own judgment once entered at the request of the parties. Appellants therefore ask that this court reverse the decision of the 10th District Court of Appeals and reinstate the well-reasoned decision of the trial court. I know that this court is certainly familiar with the facts of this case, the record, and the briefs. I simply want to amplify a few facts for your continued consideration. Sophisticated parties and counsel negotiated a very specific and detailed written agreement after 2 years of litigation. Both parties, Ice House and ODOT, asked the trial court to enter the agreement as its own order. The court did so on August 11th, 2018. 4 days later, only 4 days later, ODOT knew that it could not convey the parking mitigation property to Ice House Ventures, but did not tell Ice House or the trial court for months. Instead, what ODOT did...
Well, counsel, what's the ramifications of that?
It simply shows the import that this agreement was clear, understood by the parties, freely negotiated, and ODOT went forward, paid partial consideration, and took title to the property. It's also important, Your Honor, because the eminent domain matter was concluded. ODOT got what it wanted out of the case, title to the property, but Ice House is still seeking to get the benefit of its bargain under the agreed judgment entry.
Right, but the fact that ODOT knew that it could not satisfy that portion, what impact does that have on the measure of damages?
That clearly put them in breach, something that counsel for ODOT acknowledged at page 9 of the hearing transcript, and the order is clear. It says that ODOT must then pay damages to Ice House Ventures for ODOT's failure to convey.
But what are the damages?
The damages are the expectation damages of Ice House Ventures under its agreement with ODOT.
And what was the expectation?
The expectation was that ODOT would deliver the parking mitigation property and Ice House Ventures would get the benefit of having that property.
And so when that property can no longer be delivered, what then is the remedy?
The remedy are those expectation damages. What did Ice House lose as a result of not getting the parking property and the 12 parking spaces that would result to Ice House Ventures? It was not, respectfully, Your Honor, damages to the residue. That phrase appears nowhere in the agreed settlement order. Instead, what counsel for ODOT is asking this court to do, as it asked the 10th District, is to read into that agreement the words "to the residue," which don't exist, and read out of the agreement and the court's order the damages for the failure to deliver the parking mitigation
property. So what would make Ice House whole?
I'm sorry?
What would make Ice House whole from this breach?
The $900,000 in damages found by the court, that was Ice House's expectation damages.
Is that the value of that parcel?
That is the value of what 12 parking spaces would have provided.
But there were no 12 parking spaces there yet, right?
There were not parking spaces there yet. And both sides, ODOT included, presented measures of expectation damages to the court. ODOT's was well lower. Ice House's was even higher. But even counsel for ODOT acknowledged at page 9 of the transcript that the court was to decide what Ice House was entitled to as a result of ODOT's failure to deliver the parking property. At page 9, they said that. They didn't say damages to the residue. And then later, Your Honor, in answer to your question, at page 354 of the transcript, counsel for ODOT conceded that the trial court could award to Ice House any amount of damages it found within the range of proof. ODOT conceded that. Suddenly, at the 10th District, however, with only a passing reference in closing argument before the trial court to meeting of the minds, suddenly, before the 10th District Court of Appeals, ODOT contended that the proper measure was damages to the residue. That's what it understood all along, and yet presented no evidence of that before the trial court. ODOT concedes at page 32 of their brief, as they must, that no witness testified that their subjective understanding of the agreement was damages to the residue. It's not in the record. It doesn't exist. And yet the 10th District Court of Appeals found, well, there was a contention of ODOT that it meant damages to the residue by their lawyer. That's at paragraph 16 of the Court of Appeals opinion.
In the court order, it says damages.
Correct.
It doesn't say expectation. It doesn't say residue. It doesn't say reliance. It doesn't say anything. It just says damages.
What it actually says, Your Honor, is damages to Ice House for ODOT's failure to convey the parking property. It certainly doesn't say damages to the residue. So now you're looking at damages that sound in contract for ODOT's breach of the agreement, its failure to provide that property. What is that worth to Ice House? The trial court, based on the range of proof, could have chose $54,000 or so, or $1.4 million or so. It chose $900,000 based on specific testimony from an experienced developer. And so that provides Ice House the benefit of their bargain under the agreed settlement order. With the 10th District simply saying that, no, the contention of ODOT was that it could mean damages to the residue, the court then took the trial court to task for not affirmatively presenting evidence and finding a meeting of the minds when there was nothing to the contrary in the record. That is a dangerous precedent here in Ohio, that a party can not only upset a very clear written agreement by later claiming no meeting of the minds without evidence, but also the idea that a very clear court order can be thrown out, can be essentially vetoed by a party by later claiming, again without evidence, that we didn't understand that to which we agreed.
Does the presumption of the meeting of the minds come about from the contract itself, or from taking the contract to the court and saying, please enter this as an order, or can it be both?
It's a great question. I think it's both because of our assignment of error number one. If allowed to stand, you're going to hear about Ice House Ventures in later argument and later briefing saying, well, no, that says that even without evidence, I can contest a meeting of the minds, and the trial court needs to affirmatively make findings on that element. So it does create a problem under the agreement itself. And then the order, once entered by the court, that's our proposition of law number two. Absolutely, this court believes and has always held that a trial judge has the inherent authority to interpret and enforce its judgments. This turns that on its head and allows a party, essentially, as I mentioned a moment ago, to veto a court order by saying, I didn't understand it to mean that. This happened in this case months after the court entered its order. At that point, it is the court's order. It's not merely the agreement of the parties. And the court has to have the inherent authority to interpret
we
and
don't
enforce
need to,
its
we
orders.
We don't need to get to that issue, though, do we?
If you find that a meeting of the minds exists, if you find that that presumption is valid, there is no evidence to upset that assumption, that presumption of a meeting of the minds, and you can reverse the 10th District Court of Appeals and reinstate the decision of the trial court. You have everything before you to make that decision, to reinstate the trial court's decision, and send it back for the only issue that would remain in the case, Ice House's entitlement to attorney's fees and what amount that should be. And so I agree, Your Honor, if Proposition 1 holds, as I think it should, for businesses and Ohioans who rely upon contracting.
Aren't there some other propositions of law that would have to the 10th District would have to decide if we reversed on that point. There was a proposition on subject matter jurisdiction to award contract damages. There was a proposition in that whether or not the trial court erred in finding that ODOT breached the settlement, as well as the attorney. Wouldn't they have to decide all those issues?
No, actually, I would urge you not to remand it to the 10th District on those questions. ODOT did not present those as defenses in this matter, except perhaps the jurisdiction of the Court of Claims, which I can address in a moment, and it did not present them as conditional cross appeals. You have everything before you to decide fully and finally.
But regardless of what, they don't need to present it as conditional cross appeals. There's still issues that were not resolved by the trial court.
And I believe they could have been preserved before this court, and in fact, they did raise in their opposition to us, to our primary brief, the Court of Claims jurisdiction. That doesn't come into play. 2754, the Ohio Revised Code, deals with when a party files, quote, files a civil action, end quote, against the state. That's never happened here. Every case that ODOT cites to you for that proposition involved a subsequent civil action filed against the state. Instead, what happened here was the court,
But ODOT, I don't understand how we would decide an issue that neither side has briefed here. And that seems, you didn't ask for us to decide that issue. No one's asked us to decide that issue.
We don't believe that jurisdiction exists. We think that ODOT invoked the general jurisdiction of the Court of Common Pleas, and we know from Norwood v. Horney, coincidentally an eminent domain case.
That all may be right, but that's still not an issue before us. That's not been raised here.
I believe the Court of Claims issue has been raised for you in ODOT's opposition, and it's not appropriate because you have previously found that once jurisdiction of a trial court is invoked, that court has the jurisdiction to administer justice in this matter, and that's what happened at the trial court below.
You're saying that ODOT consented, I mean, in terms of the immunity statute, and whether it would be in the Court of Claims or in the Common Pleas Court, you're saying that, first of all, it was an appropriation matter which can go to a Common Pleas Court, but second of all, that by going to the court and asking the court to enforce its settlement, that ODOT consented at that point and waived immunity?
Respectfully, you can't consent to jurisdiction. It either exists or it doesn't. And jurisdiction absolutely exists in the General Division of the Common Pleas under the eminent domain statute. And the trial court was simply carrying out that with which it was tasked to do. I would point out to you that ODOT agreed to this procedure acknowledging that jurisdiction exists. This is only kind of a make-weight argument after the fact. And respectfully, Your Honor, the only other two assignments of error raised by ODOT was that it did not breach the settlement order. It conceded at page 9 of the transcript that it did. If you look at the language of the agreed entry, it's very specific. It doesn't give ODOT the option, hey, if we can't give you this property, we can pay you damages.
Why would ODOT have to raise assignments of errors on issues that were not considered by the Court of Appeals? Our typical procedure is that if there's unresolved issues, we send them back to be resolved by the Court of Appeals. And the substantive arguments you make may all be right, but they're not. I just don't see how they're before us.
Well, I'd say they're at issue for you because we are insisting that a presumption should exist, and the court has inherent authority to enforce its own orders. If you agree with those propositions, there's nothing left for the Court of Appeals to decide. Instead, it's more appropriate to reinstate the order of the trial court. Because the other argument that they made, that attorney's fees somehow aren't to be awarded here, that's still before the trial court. That they're not in breach, on the clear face of the record transcript and the words of the agreed settlement order, they are in breach. And so you have everything before you need to make that decision fully and finally and reinstate the trial court's order. That is what we would ask you would do. And with that, I would reserve the remaining minute and a half of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, good morning.
Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. I think counsel for Ice House said it best when he said in the trial court that there appears to be a disagreement over what it is that the parties actually settled in this case.
Well, was there really a disagreement? There was a disagreement afterwards, but that's the case anytime there's litigation about what a contract means. Is there any, if you look at what the trial court cited for disagreement was basically, yeah, well, the attorneys afterwards on the motion to enforce, they disagreed about what it meant. Well, that's always the case in a contract case, right? So what's the evidence prior to that that there was a disagreement?
Well, that's not always going to be the case, and the fact that there isn't any evidence
well,
shows
you
why...
You generally wouldn't have a dispute about the meaning of contract terms as the parties agreed on them afterward, or what they meant, right?
Certainly, if the parties agreed on the terms after the fact, you don't have a disagreement. But this court has already confronted instances where parties have disagreed about the meaning of the terms of a settlement agreement. And that shows why the 10th District's decision didn't break any new ground and why the trial court is the one that erred and why any concerns about the lack of evidence reflect the trial court's error, not ODOT's error. And I speak to the court of its decision in Rule v. Fan. And in that court, the court was faced with a disagreement after the fact over the meaning of a term in a settlement agreement. In that case, the disagreement was over the meaning of the term assets. In this case, the dispute is over the meaning of the term damages. And the court in Ruley held that the trial court there should have held a hearing when there was a legitimate dispute over the meaning of a settlement term. And so to the extent that there was no evidence in this case, the lack of evidence is because the trial court failed to follow this court's decision.
Well, wait a second. So the court should have held a hearing before the settlement was entered into because it should have anticipated that after the fact, the state would say it didn't know what damages meant.
No. To be clear, if I misspoke, the time the court should have held a hearing is after the parties reached settlement. Because in Ruley, they had reached a settlement. The settlement was read into the record. There was a hearing on that settlement. And the dispute arose at the time came to enforce the settlement. Here, the time for a hearing was after it was discovered that that ODOT could not convey this property, and the time for a damages hearing would arose. And ODOT was not seeking to avoid its obligations.
Well, there was a motion to enforce the settlement agreement. I mean, that's...
And at that point, ODOT wanted to abide by the settlement. It did not disagree that the settlement agreement needed to be enforced. The disagreement arose was, what does it mean to enforce that agreement? And that's where the question of damages arose. And at the damages hearing, ODOT wanted to present evidence of what are damages to the residue, because we think damages should be best be interpreted as damage to the residue, both on the text and the context of this agreement.
But contractually, that wasn't there. That was ODOT's position, correct? That it should be damages to the residue.
Yes, Your Honor. And the settlement agreement, as Justice Fisher, I think you asked, it doesn't specify damages to the residue. It doesn't specify expectation damages. But we think there are reasons in the text and in the context of what was settled to read this as damages to the residue.
Well, but isn't the right person to ask that as the person who entered the court order, the trial judge?
I don't think so, because I think Ruley says that when you have a settlement agreement, it is the party's agreement. And if you look at the settlement agreement here, it was signed by three parties. It was signed by the parties, and it was signed by the judge. The judge was memorializing the party's agreement, and that's what Ruley says.
But it becomes, once the judge signs it, it becomes his judgment or hers.
Well, I think...
Correct.
That is true to a certain extent. But
I think it's a court order, isn't it?
Well, what this court held in Ruley, and I quote from the first paragraph of that decision, it is not within the province of the trial judge to enforce a purported settlement agreement when the substance or the existence of that agreement is legitimately disputed. And that was a case where, again, there was an agreement that was reflected in the record of the court, and the parties disputed the meaning of that agreement. And what this court held in Ruley is that the trial court should not have just unilaterally adopted one party's reading or the other when there was a legitimate dispute over the meaning of the term.
And that was argued, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
The meaning of damages was argued to the trial court?
Yes or no? Yes.
Okay, he or she decided one way or the other, right?
No, because what the court did not do was look to what the party's understanding was. And that's what Ruley says. Ruley says you need to look to the party's understanding of the term, because otherwise the court is forcing an agreement that upon the parties that they never agreed to.
So, Mr. Peterson, you're saying the trial court did not understand that ODOT's position was damages go to the residue, and Ice House's position was no damages or expectation. You're saying the trial court did not consider that?
Either the trial court didn't fully understand it, or it didn't do what this court held in Ruley, which is to hold a hearing to see what the parties understood at the time of the agreement. And so the question about whether there is evidence of the parties' understanding of damages, that's not in the record because the trial court didn't do what it needed to do.
Well, you look at this agreement, doesn't seem to leave any question about what damages are for. It says damages due to IHV for the failure of ODOT to deliver this portion of the consideration. This portion of the consideration clearly refers to the parking spots. The only damages you could have for that would compensate for the failure to deliver the parking spots are what the parking spots are worth, right? When you add the words, is this portion of the consideration clearly referencing the parking, that doesn't seem to leave any room for ambiguity.
I think there are reasons in the text and the context. I'd like to walk through both. I'll begin with the text because that's where you also started, Your Honor. Because what it says is the consideration of ODOT's appropriation of Ice House's property. And what is consideration for appropriation of property?
Well, it doesn't say for ODOT's appropriation. It says for the failure to deliver this portion of the consideration.
Yes, Your Honor. It says failure to deliver the portion of the consideration for ODOT's appropriation.
This portion, and it's not the portion,
yes.
This portion.
Yeah, this portion,
yes. Clearly references the parking spots.
It is definitely referencing the parking spots, but the question is, what does that mean to be portion of the appropriation for Ice House's property? And damages in the agreement is used only one other time in this agreement. It's used in the very first paragraph where it says the settle amount is compensation, damages, and other consideration due to Ice House by reason of the appropriation. And I don't think anyone can dispute that in that first usage of damages, it is referring to eminent domain damages. And so in order to read damages...
This makes clear exactly what it's referring to. It says for the failure to deliver. There's no question what it's referring to in the second part.
But again,
it's not a general reference to damage. It's the specific damages for the failure to deliver a certain item.
But it's failure to deliver, and that item is consideration for the appropriation of property. And maybe if I could talk about the context, it'd help explain why we think this is the better reading of damages in this. Because in the context, as the court knows, the parties in an eminent domain proceeding are entitled to compensation for the property taken and damages to the residue. And at the time this agreement was entered in, the parties largely agreed on the amount due for compensation for the property that was taken, where the disagreement was damages to the residue. Because at the time, the parties agreed that the property that was taken was worth about $150,000. And in fact, ODOT's appraiser came in a little bit higher than Ice House's did. Where they disagreed was on damages to the residue. ODOT thought damages to the residue was around $200,000. Ice House thought damages to the residue was around $2 million. And so when the parties entered into the settlement agreement that had two parts, a $900,000 cash payment and a property swap component, they understood that $900,000 to be complete satisfaction for the property taken, and everything above that, about $150,000, was a partial payment for damages to the residue. The other portion of the payment for damages to the residue came in the property. And this settlement was possible because the parties didn't need to agree on how much this piece of property, the parking mitigation property, was worth. And I want to be clear that disagreement is not the basis for arguing there's no meeting of the minds. But what was happening there is because the parties were able to say, we value this property differently, but we both think this will make Ice House whole. They were able to reach an agreement that Ice House would be made whole with $900,000 plus this property. They recognized, though, that if the deal fell through, part of that consideration for the appropriation of Ice House's property would have never been conveyed. And so the question is, how much additional consideration for the appropriation of property might Ice House be entitled to? And that is damages to the residue. And so under ODOT's understanding, and ODOT would love to abide by this understanding, ODOT is not seeking to evade its contractual obligation here. ODOT thinks that a hearing to determine whether Ice House has been fully compensated for damages to the residue, whether they get that $900,000, or whether they're entitled to more, is the appropriate remedy in this case. Now, we think that
But if that's the appropriate remedy, then the settlement agreement just goes out the window.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, they could have got the damages, property damage to the residue, but they agreed to something else.
I don't think so, because
they agreed to get parking spots.
And this is why we think that ODOT thinks that Ice House does gain benefit from the settlement agreement, because what the settlement agreement does, even without the property swap component, is it set a floor on what Ice House was guaranteed to get. If you recall, as I said, ODOT thought Ice House was only entitled to about $300,000, $400,000. So this settlement agreement sets a floor. Ice House is guaranteed to get, at a minimum, $900,000. And then, if the property swap component couldn't play out, as the parties were well aware that it might not, that it was contingent, it was entitled to a hearing where it may get even more. The settlement agreement doesn't go out the window. There is still a significant benefit to Ice House's bargain here. And that goes to the final point about why I think you should read damages as damages to the residue, even in this disputed provision, which is there are three triggering events here. And the third triggering event is if the permits and the licenses necessary to use this as a parking lot are not obtained. And that places the burden on Ice House. Ice House's reading would have the court say that even when there was no failure of performance on behalf of ODOT, Ice House could just sit on its hands, do nothing, and come and seek an expectation damages, seek $900,000 against ODOT and against the state.
What would Ice House have to do?
I'm sorry?
What would Ice House have to do?
Well, so we think that what that provision is actually doing is it was recognized that there are some events that may occur or may not occur. The property might not be conveyed. Ice House may not be able to get the permits it needed. And if that happens,
But the permits needed isn't ODOT's problem.
That's right. That's right. And so that's why we're saying it's better to read this as damages to the residue, because if Ice House could just sit on its hands and do nothing and then seek a greater amount of damages against the state, then that wouldn't be a reasonable interpretation of the contract. Whereas if we recognize Ice House could try to get the permits and couldn't do it, they would not have been fully compensated because they wouldn't get the benefit of their bargain.
So you're saying that the damages given by the trial court assumed that based on what Ice House says, it would acquire the parcel, get it developed, have 12 spaces, and all of its expectations would be satisfied. But is it incumbent upon Ice House to show that that would have happened and could have happened, as opposed to ODOT showing that even if we convey this property, these 12 spaces could not be developed?
And I think the answer to the question is it comes back to when you have contract damages, when you have expectation damages, that's a result of a failure of performance. And so then the question is who has to perform under that section really arises. But if you treat this as eminent domain damages and as basically a substitute for cash consideration for appropriation of the property, then it doesn't really matter who fails to perform because this exists as a safety valve. There are some conditions subsequent that may not occur. And in order to guarantee that Ice House gets what's entitled to from the very beginning, which is compensation for the property taken and damages to the residue, that's when this is sort of a triggering event for condition.
Is there any condition Ice House could have held if this property was not offered as part of the eminent domain package?
I don't fully understand.
For instance, if this property was not available to even offer as part of the agreement, is there anything that would have been different from the eminent domain proceedings against Ice House? I mean, in other words, would the proceedings have still taken place? Are there any defenses or anything Ice House could have done to not have this happen? Or is it a matter of they would gotten additional payment for the eminent domain proceedings?
Ice House would have gotten additional payment for eminent domain proceedings, and that's what ODOT has wanted all along to provide through an eminent domain damages hearing. For these reasons, we would ask the court.
Mr. Peterson,
Isn't it correct that the first time the residual damages argument was made was before the Court of Appeals and not before the Common Pleas Court?
That is incorrect, Your Honor, and it does not accurately represent the record.
All right, thank you.
Counselor, if you could start with the question I asked last. If this property, this parcel for development of the parking spaces, was not part of the agreement, if it was not in the picture at all, what would be Ice House's position during the eminent domain proceedings?
Well, I presume, Your Honor, that the parties would have negotiated a larger amount of cash if they weren't going to take this additional and different consideration. So I don't think we'd be having this discussion.
So then why isn't the proper nature of the damages that Ice House should get the additional amount it would have gotten had these spaces not been there? Because there's no way Ice House could have stopped the proceedings.
Because correct? It resolved the eminent domain action, and this became a matter of contract. What are we entitled to for the breach of this agreement? That's why.
So you're saying this is separate and apart from the eminent domain proceedings?
Oh, absolutely. Still within the court's jurisdiction that ODOT invoked, but absolutely a matter of contract at that point, and the court's ability to enforce its own order. Very quickly on the issue of remand, if you agree with Proposition 1 or 2, remand to the 10th District in what I believe has already been a results-oriented decision serves no purpose. You will have found that ODOT is in breach as they acknowledge, or the trial court properly found that ODOT is in breach.
Well,
you will have found.
I mean, the only thing that we would resolve is that there was a meeting of the minds, that there was a contract, right?
You would be resolving, presumably, that there was a meeting of the minds. I hope that you would also presume the court is fully empowered to enforce its own order. And if you find those things, then the court acted properly, the trial court did, and the only appropriate decision, in my mind, in this case that has lingered since 2016 to the detriment of Ice House Ventures, is to reinstate the trial court's order. If ODOT believes those grounds are still live, they can raise them at a later time, but I believe that you should reinstate that well-reasoned opinion. This otherwise presents a real threat to the finality and reliability of contract in the state and a real threat to the authority of trial courts to enforce their own orders.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll receive a decision in the mail. Thank you for being here today.